Good afternoon. My name is Leanne Hope. I'm going to be talking to you about the experiences of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex, or LGBTI, asylum seekers and some of the resettlement challenges that they experience in Massachusetts. I have nothing to disclose. So I'll be taking you through a little bit about how this research came about, some background on asylum, as well as how sexual orientation and gender identity became a protected group within the U.S. asylum system. I'll tell you a bit about my research, as well as some emerging themes that came out of that, and finally recommendations moving forward on how to better provide service provision for LGBTI asylum seekers. So throughout my research, as well as for the structure of this presentation, this is the model I use. I am a public health social worker. And basically what this says is that there are many ways to impact health, from individual therapy to policy enactment. And what we all know as public health professionals is that we need to focus on the bottom of the pyramid, because it is important to make a large impact. So why do LGBTI people seek asylum? Currently, there are 78 countries that criminalize same-sex activity between two consenting adults. There are many more countries that restrict, that have non-criminal laws that restrict the rights of LGBTI people. And so what we're experiencing is a lot of community violence in countries like Uganda, Jamaica, Russia, parts of Latin America, including Guatemala, El Salvador, which I like how there is some overlap between the presentations you've already seen. The first presentation definitely talked a lot about that community violence in Burkina Faso, so this is the same type of community violence. And so what we're seeing is that a lot of LGBTI people around the world are experiencing harassment, assault, arrest, torture, and death. So they're fleeing from their countries of origin. They are in fear for their life, and they are in desperate need of safety. So another thing to point out is the reason why a lot of LGBTI people choose to go through the asylum system versus the refugee system is, again, because they have to flee immediately, so they don't have time to go through the refugee system. But the other reason is that they choose not to go to a refugee camp because they would potentially be targets of the same type of persecution that they experienced initially. We also don't know the exact number of LGBTI asylum seekers in the U.S., and that's mainly because the government doesn't track that information. Even if they did, it would still be very difficult to have an accurate estimate because there are a lot of people who self-identify as LGBTI who are not filing under that particular category. If they qualify for, let's say, political asylum, they might choose that instead. So it would also be very hard to tell. There's also a number of people who don't identify as LGBTI that are filing under this category of sexual orientation and gender identity because perhaps they did experience violence because of the perception of their sexual orientation or gender identity. So a little bit about asylum eligibility. I'll just do this very, very briefly. This is the definition of a refugee, so all asylum seekers have to meet this definition. And the reason why LGBTI people are eligible is because they are considered a membership to a social group. And the way the U.S. defines social group is a group of people who share a common, immutable characteristic that the members of the group are cannot or should not be required to change. So something that is fundamental to one's identity. So this became a social group in 1994 after this case, Matter of Toboso Alfonso, which was led by former General Attorney Janet Reno, was successfully won and created a precedent. So since then, nearly all precedential asylum claims have involved gay men. And so what that means is that there aren't a lot of guidelines on how to assess lesbian cases. So that creates some problems for women. And also that the success rate for claims made by bisexual people is very, very low. Finally, those who identify as transgender have not been explicitly considered members of a social group. However, there have been a few non-precedential cases, successful ones, that have been based on this ground. So basically, there is a disparate level of how tough this system is for different folks. So for my methodology, I did a mixed methods approach. I did a formative evaluation of services in Massachusetts. I wanted to look at how many services there were for LGBTI asylum seekers. I also wanted to know what kind of care, if they were offering LGBTI-informed as well as trauma-informed care. And then I also interviewed providers and asylum seekers. And I came up with four emerging themes, and I'm going to go through each one. So first, identity issues. A lot of LGBTI asylum seekers are having an internal struggle in relation to their identity or orientation. They feel a lot of shame and guilt, sort of like I brought this on myself in relation to their how they ended up having to become or having to resettle. This often leads to a lot of depression and anxiety. Many of them don't feel comfortable sharing the fullness of themselves with anyone. Many of them hide their sexuality. So this is a problem. You're seeing mental health issues. You're seeing that they may not be able to get the appropriate assistance and support they need from providers if they're not fully disclosing. And many providers are reporting that it takes longer to complete an affidavit with their LGBTI clients because they're realizing that it takes a lot of time first to help their clients work through some of that internal identity issue before even touching their case. So the second theme is problems with providers. So overall, I found a lack of LGBTI-informed care among providers. I did see that there was some trauma-informed care. I saw that a lot of providers understood how to have conversations about race, about gender, about religion, but not so much LGBTI-informed care. And what I mean by that is not a lot of providers necessarily knew how to talk about preferred gender pronouns. They didn't necessarily have awareness around, what is heteronormative language, what it is when you say something that is microaggressive. And then even just going to the labels, which I appreciated the second presenter in talking about labels and searching for labels on the internet, I found that a lot of providers didn't really know that, the concept that LGBTI is a Western concept and that a lot of asylum seekers, they don't use any of those labels. Secondly, I found that there wasn't a lot of programming and there wasn't a lot of funding for LGBTI asylum seekers. So there is one and only one in Massachusetts organization dedicated to LGBTI asylum seekers. They only have enough funding to support 8 to 10 asylum seekers at a time for a limited amount of time, only until each client receives their Social Security. There's a number of other generalist organizations, but a lot of those have stipulations as to who is eligible. So these organizations, maybe you have to have HIV, maybe you have to be a victim of domestic violence, maybe you have to be Black or Latino, maybe you have to be a torture survivor. And so what we're seeing is that a lot of LGBTI asylum seekers, they only qualify for those services if they happen to also be in that other category. But what we're seeing is that a lot of people don't fit into those categories and are being referred out and are being basically rejected by a lot of these agencies. Also, there are very, very few support groups in Massachusetts. I found that a lot of LGBTI asylum seekers, a lot of them are ready to socialize, to meet other people. They want community. They want to meet other people that are similar to them, but we just don't have that structure. So structural barriers. LGBTI asylum seekers are often excluded on the basis of their sexual minority status. So for all asylum seekers and refugees, regardless of sexuality, one thing that they do when they go to their host country is they find their ethnic or religious enclave. And this is very, very important to survival, because once they find that enclave, those are the folks that are going to help them find a lawyer, navigate the healthcare system, house them. And so that gets complicated for LGBTI asylum seekers because they could be targets of the same discrimination that they faced in their country of origin. So some asylum seekers will go and reach out to these ethnic and religious communities, but they might stay in the closet, and that's very painful for them because they're in constant fear that their sexuality might be found out. A lot of folks choose not to access these communities at all, again, because of that fear that they might be discriminated against. And it reminds them of the reason that they fled in the first place. They also don't feel like they fit in with the American LGBTI community. And even beyond that, with the general U.S. public, they're also not only marginalized based on their sexual minority status, they're also marginalized based on race and based on their legal status. So overall, this is not good. We're seeing a lot of isolation and a lot of depression. Okay, last theme, federal structure. So I looked at some of these policies that serve to as barriers for successful resettlement. And so we have the one-year filing deadline, we have the processing backlog, and a six-month wait for a work permit. And I'm being told that I need to wrap up. So I'm just going to basically say, I still have 1 minute. So basically, these structures, they're just really tough. So in Massachusetts, there is a huge backlog, processing backlog. There's supposed to be an immigration officer that comes to process these claims. We have not seen one in 2 years, so people are in limbo. That's a problem. Also, the six-month wait for a work permit. So once someone files a claim, is when they can then apply for. They have to wait 6 months until they can apply for their employment authorization. That is really rough, because that means they have no means of income for at least 6 months, and for a lot of people, it's beyond 6 months, because sometimes it takes a while to file a claim. So you have people who are feeling helpless, relying on the generosity of others, and finding ways to make money under the table. So overall, we have folks that are dealing with political barriers. We have folks that are struggling with their sexuality, and also being told by providers that they have to relive their trauma history, the trauma that they experienced. Bottom line is that in the U.S., refugee and asylum issues, it's not a sexy thing to fund. There are very few foundations that will provide grants for a direct service. And, it's hard. We can throw ice buckets at each other and raise money for ALS, but it is just very difficult to fund this. This is a very vulnerable and very isolated population. So finally, recommendations. I'm actually going to tell you a little bit about, maybe make this an action slide, and tell you about some of the things that we're doing. So right now I'm working with the Boston Center for Refugee Health and Human Rights. We're trying to raise money to secure, to create a curriculum and a trauma and LGBT-informed care model to provide support groups for gay and lesbian clients. And we're hoping that to have an evaluation component and hopefully add to that research. And if you want to know anything else about LGBT asylum, please talk to me afterwards.